For our seventh Frederick Douglass lecture, we have with us Mr. John H. Johnson of Chicago. He's the publisher of Ebony, Tan, Jet, and the Negro Digest. He attended Northwestern University. In 1951, he was named one of the 10 outstanding young men of the year by the United States Junior Chamber of Commerce. In fact, he was the first Negro businessman selected for that honor. Last year, in 1966, he received the Horatio Alger Award, and his talk later will indicate why the Horatio Alger Award might have been awarded to him. He received also last year the John Russwurm Award of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, and he also received last year, which must have been a bumper year, the Spingarn Medal of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In 1955, he attained a recognition of which Frederick Douglass several times nearly attained, but of which he was always deprived throughout his life, and that was an invitation to dinner at the White House. In 1957, he accompanied Vice President Nixon to Africa, and in 1959, he accompanied him to Russia and Poland. In 61, he represented the United States at the independence of the Ivory Coast, and in 63, at the independence of Kenya. He's a director of the Marina City Bank and of the Service Federal Savings and Loan Association and of the Magazine Publishers Association, of the Chicago Association of Commerce and Industry, and of the National Conference of Christians and Jews. He's also a trustee of Howard University and a trustee of Fisk University. He's vice president of the National Urban League, and he's chairman of the board of the Supreme Life Insurance Company of America. He has 2 honorary degrees, and he also has 2 children. He's been asked, as our other speakers have, and I think you're all familiar with this formula, but I repeat it so that he will know that I warned you, that he was asked to talk about himself and to give an autobiographical account, so that I repeat once again that it's not his egocentricity that leads to such a subject. In fact, he says he's never had an opportunity to talk on such a subject before. And he's taken as the title tonight, "The Dark is Light Enough." Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President, and friends. I am very happy to be in Rochester. It's also my first time to be in Rochester. And it's also my first time to talk about myself. I've been so busy trying to get ahead in the magazine business that I really haven't had much time to think about myself. I am delighted to be here, and I'm going to talk to you, as he said before, on the subject, "The Dark is Light Enough." And my reason for selecting such a subject is I feel that in times like these, very often, we're not taking advantages of all the opportunities we have. And this is not to say that we should not press very hard to get as many advantages as we should, but we also feel you ought to take advantage of those you have. I recall that many people that I talked to in the early days about helping me to get started in the magazine business were unwilling to give me any money, but some of them gave me advice, and some of the advice was good. So I think we have to take people are willing to give, and we have to press them continually to give us more. As an editor and publisher of 4 magazines that grew out of the same vision that brought Frederick Douglass to Rochester in November of 1847, I am of course honored by this opportunity to participate in this commemoration of this great American's birth. In the course of his remarkable rise from slavery to freedom, Frederick Douglass illuminated the whole American social order and made all Americans his debtors. And he remains today and will always remain a beacon of hope and light, reflecting for all times the hidden possibilities of the disadvantaged of all races, creeds, and colors. All Americans are also indebted to the University of Rochester for this imaginative remembrance of Douglass's life and hope. For all Americans need Douglass's example to enrich their lives and to fulfill their own hopes. Although this seminal figure died 72 years ago, he speaks with uncommon authority and eloquence to the needs of this hour. He speaks not only to the disadvantaged, who can see in him what they themselves can become, but also to the biased and the privileged, who can see in him how much America is losing by its failure to utilize the full range of available human resources. For more than 20 years, the Johnson Publishing Company has been active in the struggle to bring about a wider appreciation of Frederick Douglass and the historical tradition which he represents. Over the years, Negro Digest, Jet, and Ebony have printed scores of articles on Douglass's life and work. And it was in the September 1953 issue of Ebony magazine, for example, that Mary Church Terrell made the widely quoted statement that Douglass was the most illustrious Negro and, quote, "to my mind, the greatest of all Americans." 10 years later, when we published a special issue commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, we could think of no one more worthy of the cover space than Frederick Douglass. As a publisher and as a man, I have been deeply influenced by Douglass's image and by his ideas. I am indebted, of course, to him for his pioneering efforts in journalism and for the high standards he maintained as an editor and publisher. But beyond all that, I and millions of other dark-skinned Americans are indebted to Douglass for proving in tight and dangerous places that Christopher Fry was right when he said, quote, "the dark is light enough." There was little light in Arkansas City, Arkansas, where I was born on January 19, 1918. There were few opportunities for Negro Americans in Arkansas City and fewer Negro models to guide and shape the aspirations of the young. To make matters worse, my family was poor. My father was a sawmill worker, and my mother was a domestic who ran a personal laundry business on the side. And to this very day, I'm pretty good at ironing shirts. And I also learned how to cook, which I would urge all mothers to teach their sons. But there is poverty, and then there's poverty. Poverty of the first kind is a matter of the absence of certain things deemed necessary for physical and spiritual health. When this kind of poverty is endured too long, when it foils every effort to escape, it robs the victim of the only thing that it can get him out of poverty, and that is hope. My parents lacked material things, but they did not lack hope. On the contrary, they had a deep and abiding faith in what philosophers call, quote, "the silent power of the possible." I don't know how or why that deep faith lived on in my parents' hearts. I only know that it was there and that it guided me in my blind groping for a way out and up. At that time, there were only two Negroes in Arkansas City with a college education, and they were the only Negroes who wore dress suits and ties on weekdays. This fact impressed me greatly, and I adopted these two men. One was a minister, and the other was an elementary school principal. and I adopted them as models of hope and aspiration. My aspirations were sharpened later when the minister and principal told me that the road to dress suits and personal advancement ran through places called high school and college. It was in this way that I made my first tentative connection between education and power. This was, in a sense, a small thing, but it is of such small things that dreams and ladders of hope are made. But dreams, as Frederick Douglass pointed out 100 years ago, must be grounded on a plan and on a willingness to see things through. Here again, I was helped enormously by my mother, who became the head of the family after the death of my father in my sixth year. I recall vividly the day in the 20s when we sat down and surveyed the situation and mapped out a plan of action. Since there was no high school for Negroes in Arkansas City, we decided to move to Chicago, where there were wider vistas and larger opportunities. Under the original plan, we were going to leave Arkansas City after I finished the top grade, the eighth grade, in the only Negro high school. But when that day came, there was not enough money to finance a trip north. My mother, who had a horror of young men loitering on street corners, made me return to the same school that I'd just been graduated from, and made me complete a second year. And so today I hold two diplomas from the eighth grade. And the second time I was graduated with honors. By the time I finished the eighth grade for the second time, the money was in hand and we entrained for Chicago, where we arrived on Friday, September 1st, 1933. I immediately enrolled in a high school named for Wendell Phillips, who was Douglass's colleague in the abolitionist movement. When Wendell Phillips High School burned down, I transferred to the new DeSable High School, which bore the name of a bold Negro explorer who was the first permanent settler and the first businessman in the Chicago area. In the meantime, in the deepening depression crisis, my mother was struggling to make enough money to feed me and to keep me in school. These were desperate days, especially for Negro Americans. Jobs were at a premium, and millions of men and women were walking the streets seeking employment. My mother, like millions of others, trampled from employment office to employment office and from kitchen to kitchen. Like millions of other Americans, she was turned down and turned away. And she, like millions of others, was forced to seek public relief. There is a rather romantic notion abroad that Negroes seek relief out of a hatred for work. Speaking from personal experience, I can say that that view is totally unfounded. My mother and I, like millions of other Negroes, accepted public welfare for several years, not because it was our ambition to do so, but because it was the only way to keep body and soul together. But as Ralph Waldo Emerson has said, every wall is a door. And what that means in the context of the deprived is that every disadvantage contains the seeds of a potential advantage. But to find and exploit that advantage, one must retain a sense of expectancy and hope. Above all else, one must control one's emotions. The man who sits down and waits in adversity is doomed. If we find, Frederick Douglass said, we must seek. If we want the door to open, we must knock. Whether the door opens or not, we must lean against it with all our might. My mother and I were well aware of the great white walls surrounding the Chicago ghetto, but we never stopped looking for a door. And in time, certain doors opened. One of these doors, in fact, opened as a direct result of motion stimulated by disadvantage. Since I liked the money and the clothes to support a vigorous social life, I concentrated on extracurricular activities, serving as editor of the school paper, editor of the yearbook, president of the senior class, and president of the student council. As a direct result of these activities, I won a scholarship to the University of Chicago and was honored by a local civic group. And it was at this meeting that I met a man who changed the whole course of my life. I refer here to the late Harry H. Pace, who was then president of the Supreme Life Insurance Company, the largest Negro business in the North. Mr. Pace, who was familiar with my work on the school newspaper, urged me to continue my education and arranged for me to work part-time while attending classes at the University of Chicago and Northwestern University. I later became a full-time employee of the company, serving successfully as assistant editor and managing editor of the employee publication, and later as assistant to the president of the company. This, as I have often said, was a great turning point in my life, for unlike so many of my contemporaries, I was brought into direct contact with bold and imaginative Negro businessmen. They were graduates of Harvard, Yale, Northwestern, and the University of Illinois. These men were handling and investing large sums of money and managing and directing trans-state business operations. One of the major problems today in motivating young Americans, young Negro Americans, is their lack of direct exposure to large-scale business operations. For motivation is concrete. It grows out of what one can feel, what one can see, and what one can touch. If he is unable to see or even imagine large-scale business operations, many young Negroes naturally lose interest in independent business activity. I am sure that I would not have entered the business world had I not been exposed to that world at an early age. My early exposure to the inner workings of a large corporation influenced my whole business career, and it led to my election in 1966 as chairman of the board of directors of the Supreme Life Insurance Company, where I began my business life as a lowly apprentice. And that company was the largest Negro business in the North and still is the largest Negro business in the North. One of the major problems of the future will be the creation of conditions that provide concrete business exposure for ambitious young Negroes. At the same time, bright young Negroes must push their way into industries and associate with and observe leading businessmen in the business environment. Because of my work on the company magazine, it was necessary for me to attend meetings and conferences with the leading executives of the company. This was an excellent opportunity to study the mechanics of decision making and high-level business operations, and I made the most of that opportunity. As I worked, I kept my eyes open for business opportunities, for at that time, I was thinking in terms of running my own business. And of course, another reason was that I had recently been married and my wife was pushing me. The opportunity I was seeking grew out of my work at the insurance company. The president, who was advanced in age, asked me to read all periodicals and prepare a digest of Negro-oriented articles. From time to time, I would discuss these digests with friends and relatives. And as their response prompted me to publish Negro Digest, a monthly condensation of Negro-oriented articles in magazines and newspapers. The major problem, of course, was money. How was I going to finance the magazine? I approached several potential investors and got the same response that Douglass got back in 1847 when he was organizing the North Star. I was told, in other words, that I was crazy and that no one needed or wanted such a magazine. Many reminded me, as they reminded Douglass, of the long string of failures by Negro magazines. And I told them, as Douglass told his daughters, that the only answer to a long string of failures is a stunning success. I was convinced, as Douglass was convinced, that my magazine would be a success. My view, unfortunately, was a minority view. I finally went to a finance company and pawned my mother's furniture for $500. And with that capital base, I persuaded a printer to extend credit. And by working nights, my wife and I prepared the first copy in November 1942. Within a week, all copies were sold. I recall that when we first started the Digest, I went to the local distributor, who happened to be white, and asked him would he put our magazines on the newsstands. And he said, well, Johnson, as he said, people don't want a Negro magazine. You know we can't sell any books like that. So I simply said to him, I could have cursed him and I could have criticized him, but I simply said to him, if there is a demand for such a magazine, will you put it on the newsstand? He said, of course I'll put it on the newsstands if there's a demand. So I arranged for about 25 or 30 of my friends to go around to all the newsstands to establish the demand. And then several days later, Mr. Levy called me and he said, Johnson, you know, I think I'll take a few of those books. And then after the magazines were well distributed, I arranged for these same people to go around and buy up all these magazines. And then, of course, Mr. Levy thought I had an overwhelming success. And then he did what he should have done all along. He gave the magazine distribution, exposure, and the magazine became a success. Within a year, we were selling roughly about 50,000 copies. And I recall that somehow we were not able to sell more than 50,000 copies after about a year. And this was during the early war years when many whites were giving much advice to Negroes about what they should do. Some said that we should not fight in a war. Others said that we should not be given opportunities to do certain things. And so it occurred to me late one night, why not have a series of articles called If I Were a Negro, in which we would ask prominent whites to put themselves in the place of Negroes and to decide for themselves, if they were Negro, would they be as patient as they were urging us to be? Would they be willing for their children to go to second-rate schools? Would they be willing to be working on second-rate jobs? In other words, what would they do if they were Negro? I recall writing a letter to Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt and asking her if she would respond and write such an article. Back came a reply saying that she would like to do it, but she just did not have the time. I recall that about several weeks later, I wrote her again and said, well, now, do you have the time now? And back came another reply saying she still didn't have the time. And then I remember reading in the newspapers that she was going to be in Chicago and would be staying at a certain hotel. So I sent her a telegram and asked her, do you still have time? And it just happened that she did have some time, and she wrote this article for us called If I Were a Negro. It was by Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, whose husband was then President of the United States. It appeared in the October 1943 issue of Negro Digest, and our circulation as a result of this one article jumped from 50,000 to more than 150,000 in 1 month. And so that this really was the turning point in our success in the magazine publishing business. But then they had a law in those days called the Excise Profits Tax. And what it really said is that if you didn't start out with any money, you were not entitled to keep any money. And since I didn't start out with any money, it was very clear that they weren't going to let me keep any money. So a very wise accountant suggested to me that my position should be that I should start a new magazine, which would lose a lot of money during the period that the tax was on, and would then make money by the time the tax was off. And I assure you that it did just what he said. It lost a lot of money. As a matter of fact, the Negro Digest in those days, it was published that we were selling about 150,000 copies a month. And as I recall, we were netting about $16,000 a month. And in a period of about 2 years, I had roughly $200,000 in the bank, and the banker would call me up every day saying, "Mr. Johnson, what shall I do with all this money? Don't you want to invest it?" And then I started Negro Digest, and he would call me up and say, "What shall I do with these checks that you don't have enough money to cover?" So the net result was that we lost the money that the government would have taken anyway in building up Ebony Magazine. And by the time that Ebony was ready for success and ready to make money, the tax was released, and Ebony became a successful publication. When we started Ebony, most Negro newspapers were oriented primarily around protests, and white-oriented periodicals ignored Negro marriages, social events, successes, and so forth. So we decided, therefore, that there was room for a picture magazine which would concentrate on Negro achievement and the little-noted social and cultural activities of Negro Americans. The new magazine, which, as I said before, which was called Ebony, appeared on the stands for the first time in November 1945. It was an immediate success, and today it has a circulation of over 1 million and is the largest circulated Negro periodical in the world. We now have roughly 250 full-time employees. We have offices in Chicago, New York, Washington, Los Angeles, and about 2 years ago we opened an office in Paris. From the beginning, I considered Ebony as a vehicle for projecting and building the image of the Negro in America, an image that had been shattered and distorted by media primarily oriented to other Americans. I felt then, and I feel now, that every man must have a wholesome image of himself before he can demand respect from others. Ebony was born with a task in mind of changing the negative image of Negro Americans. We believe that once that image had been correctly altered, Negro Americans would, by their own newfound strength, force others to look upon them with greater respect. Over the years, Ebony has changed with the changing aspirations of the people it serves. Negroes have become more aggressive in all areas, and Ebony has broadened its format to reflect the contemporary aspirations of its readers. We have also added additional magazines to reflect every facet of Negro life. We have TAN, which was founded in 1950, JET, which was founded in 1951, and which is now the largest circulated Negro news weekly. Frederick Douglass, who anticipated so many of the major problems of our day, put his finger on the two major weaknesses of the Negro press. He said the first was subscriptions and the second was advertisements. One notes with appreciation that Douglass's first paper stated that the subscription rates were $2 a year, always in advance, Mr. Douglass said. And he deplored the fact that he was forced to depend on advertisements for ointments and all kinds of pills, and as he said, all kinds of horse medicines. The publication of Ebony forced us to grapple with these historic problems. The first problem, subscriptions, was relatively easy. I do recall receiving a letter from a man in St. Louis who asked me what assurance could I give him that Ebony would be in business a year from then, and I confess I wasn't able to give him very much, but he sent us the money anyway. Ebony appeared 98 years after the publication of the North Star. The Negro market at that time was larger and better educated. Our mission in 1945 was to provide a good product and a good subscription department to service it. At Ebony, as at Life and at Look and in most periodicals today, the work in subscriptions is done by highly sophisticated computers. The second problem, that of getting advertisements, was more complex. In the beginning, Ebony's ads were marginal. There was great resistance on the part of advertising agencies who were skeptical about risking their clients' dollars in a new field. We met this resistance in three stages. First, we outsold our white counterparts 10 and 15 to 1 in Negro areas. Secondly, we hired research statisticians to prove it. Finally, in a last-ditch effort, I personally called on the presidents of many major corporations. And in calling on them, I did my homework on who they were, what their interests were, and what could we do to influence them. I recall that our second ad, major national ad, was sold to Commander McDonald from the Zenith Corporation. The commander was a very opinionated and imposing man. They often said that he was president of everything at Zenith, including all the desks, all the erasures, all the typewriters, and everyone who came in to see him bowed at the waist and said, you know, yes, Commander. I recall that in reading about his biography that he had been at the North Pole with Perry, and that a Negro, Matthew Henson, had been there with him. And so when I went in to see the commander, the first thing he said to me when I opened the door, he said, young man, do you see those snowshoes over there? And I had been briefed, so I bowed and said, yes, Commander. He said, those were given to me by a Negro man who was twice as good as any white man I know. Do you know Matthew Henson? I said, yes, I know of him, Commander. He said, you know, I understand that somebody did a book on Matt. Do you know anything about it? I said, I just happen to have an autographed copy, Commander. So I gave him the autographed copy. And he said, young man, you know, if you have a magazine that's worth its salt in your field, you should have a story about Matt. I said, I just happen to have an issue that carries a story about Matt. So then we chatted and talked about Matthew Henson and what he did at the North Pole. And finally he said, he looked through the magazine. He said, I don't see why we shouldn't be advertising in this magazine. So he buzzed for his advertising manager who had a bad foot and who limped in and bowed at the waist and said, yes, Commander. He said, Mackie, the man's name was Mackie, why aren't we in Ebony Magazine? And Mackie said, we're considering it, Commander. He neglected to tell the commander that he'd been considering it for about 5 years. Well, anyway, the commander gave us the ad, and this was in 1950, and we've been running the Zenith ad ever since. So I think the important thing here is that we recognized what the problem was, we studied the human elements, and we were able to sell it. And we have found that in our field, as in all other fields, growth brings new problems as well as new opportunities. There's increasing competition today from many white-oriented publications for personnel and feature space advantage. In the face of this competition, I think Negro publishers must motivate more young people to enter the field, and we must offer our employees the same benefits offered by white companies. Many people, when they come to our office, want to know, well, do we employ white people? Yes, we do employ white people. We say to them, as they often say to us, we don't have as many as we'd like, but we do have some. As a matter of fact, things got so desperate for a while that we used to pass off light-skinned Negro people as white in order to boost our percentage. But it's up now, legitimately, and we're very proud about it. I think that as publishers in the Negro field, we must meet the challenge not only from electronic media and white-oriented print media, but also in the same spirit, for ultimately the competition will redound to the benefit of the consumer. People often ask me, for example, what will happen to Ebony when integration comes? Will you go out of business? And I always say, well, why should I go out of business? Why can't Life go out of business or Look go out of business? We say we will not go out of business. As a matter of fact, the things that come very easy to white publications are things that we've had to fight very hard for. Whenever a white publication comes out, they are immediately available on newsstands throughout the country. But we have had to fight for our space, stand by stand, railroad station by railroad station, airport by airport, and so I feel that if I could be publisher of a magazine serving all the people, we'd have 90% of the market instead of 10% of the market, and we wouldn't really have to work as hard. So that we welcome the day when there will be complete integration and when all magazines can serve all the people. We do not want to continue in a segregated society. We want to have an open society. We want to be able to go out for the markets and to sell to all the people. And as I remind my white colleagues, because we have worked in servants' capacity, we've had more experience at serving white people than they've had at serving us. So I have a feeling that if we were free to serve them in terms of getting out a magazine that they would like and appreciate, we could do a better job for them than they can do for us. I feel that we are moving into a spacious future, a future which will undoubtedly open new areas of usefulness for Negro media. We look forward, as I've said today before, to the day when all media will reflect the total aspirations of all the people all the time. But until this day arrives, we intend to do the very best job we can in reflecting the total human aspirations of a people who do not find an image of their hope and an image of their condition in other media. We feel that only by meeting our task in this area can we bring about that great day of which Frederick Douglass dreamed, the day, quote, in which there shall be no north, no south, no east, no west, no black, and no white, but a solidarity of the nation. Thank you.
Johnson is willing to respond to questions. Who would like to start off the first one? One way up in the back here. Probably the best thing is if you just come and point at any hands you see, and
yeah, okay.
It will help to repeat the question.
Okay, all right. Why don't you stay here with me and you can help me?
You don't need any.
Okay. What's the question? Well, I first of all believe that Frazier was wrong. I don't think it was make-believe. What we tried to give was hope. I mean, at Ebony, we ran success stories. I think we learned from others. In other words, we have to be inspired by something. Young people have to have something that they can emulate. They must know that black people can succeed. Now, this isn't to say that we shouldn't be fighting for all of the civil rights that we can achieve. This does not mean that we should not be militant. It simply means that while we are militant, we are also taking advantage of all the opportunities which are available to us. And so we say to present hope and to present examples of achievement to me is not make-believe. These people were real. You could see them, you could feel them, perhaps you could even smell some of them. So now, as for who we reach, I think you should only read some of the letters. Some of them are hardly legible. People can't even write their names who write to say that they enjoy looking at the photographs. No, I think that we have to show all sides. We deal with the poverty. As I said before, I'm a good example of poverty. But we also have to deal with people who are successful. We deal with reality, I think. Was there anything else? Okay. Yes, were you going to say something? Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember one which I considered very competitive was Our World, which we bought at an auction. I would only say this. I think that we had hope, and I think we had conviction. And as I said before, I think the turning point in Ebony was our ability to sell national advertising. And I think that stemmed, first of all, from our willingness to study the subject, to understand him, and to try and realize what would influence him the act. And I think we were fortunate in getting some good people. We also kept pace with the times. Now, as I said before, when Ebony first came out, we were not militant. We dealt primarily with success stories. And most of our heroes were Lena Horne and people who were in the entertainment field. But as the Negroes' interests changed, we changed. And so our heroes became Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the Urban League, Lester Grange of the Urban League. And we tried to reflect the changes that were going on in Negro society. For example, whether we agree with them or not, we have had stories on Stokely Carmichael, we've had stories on CORE, we've had stories on SNCC and other organizations. In other words, we have presented all the things that are going on in the Negro community. And we have said that these are the changes that are coming about and you should know about them. And I think by keeping pace with the changing times, I think we've been able to sell more copies of Ebony. As a matter of fact, we've doubled our circulation in the last 5 years. We were selling about 500,000 copies 5 years ago. Today we're selling 1,100,000 today. I think it's due, first of all, to keeping pace with the times, and secondly, to doing an aggressive job of selling advertising, which we've done. We hired a research director who was a PhD, who could document the fact that the Negro income was going up and that they did represent a market. We advertised full pages in the New York Times, the same as Time and Life and other magazines. We joined all the trade associations. We sent out the same type of subscription letters that Time and Life sent out. I recall that up until 1954, we were essentially a newsstand magazine. We sold all of our sales on the newsstands. And then something happened in this country, I don't know what happened, and people became subscription-minded. And so we changed from newsstand emphasis to subscription emphasis. And so we have tried to keep pace with the times, and I think if there's any reason for our success, it's that. And fortunately, the company is owned by my wife, my mother, and myself, and I did not have to convince a board of directors that times were changing. You know, yes, you have a question? My advice to young Negro students is, first of all, to get all the education you can get. I think we're living in an age now when you cannot get anywhere without education and without training. My second suggestion would be that you try to think of some area of interest which you have and to concentrate on being very good at that. Whenever people come to my office and I ask them what can they do and they say I can do anything, then I know I don't want that person. I want someone who can do a particular thing well. And speaking of that other magazine that you referred to, I recall that some years ago they had a Christmas article on 54 ways to make a fruitcake. And Ebony had an article on the one best way to make a fruitcake. And I think that's the difference. yeah, so you gonna say something? Well, I would say I'm against it. That's a quick answer. In other words, I don't believe that we ought to have any organization which is holding up any racial group as superior to another. And I feel that the John Birch Society does do this, and therefore we're against it. I think if it has any role, it serves to unify the liberal forces of the country and thereby helps to upgrade the Negro generally. Any other questions? Yeah. Well, I don't think it's defunct. I think it's going through a period of change. I think that we've got to think of new techniques for getting our voices heard and for getting our points over. You know, most people go through periods when they're not quite sure what to do. You know, the whole country doesn't quite know what to do in Vietnam. And I think if the president, with all of his advisors, doesn't quite know what to do, I don't think we should be too critical of some of the civil rights leaders who are not quite sure what we should do. I think we had a honeymoon of unity, which we always have when you have brief periods and brief coalitions. I don't think it's defunct. I think that what we are having now is a permanent kind of relationship in which each group will play a certain role. I mean, I think it was unrealistic for the Urban League and the NAACP and SNCC and CORE to be completely together on every issue. I see no reason why they shouldn't have separate points of view. You know, I very often, I recall that I went to see an advertiser some years ago, and he was telling me, well, why don't you Negro newspaper editors get together? And I say, well, gee, the white newspaper editors don't get together. So I think we have diversified opinions among whites on what should be done, or we wouldn't have the various political parties that we have or the various kinds of civic groups that we have. So I see no reason why Negroes should not disagree about what techniques they want to use. I think we need all of them. And I don't think we ought to be critical of any man's point of view. I think if a guy wants to shout black power, he ought to have a right to do it. Or if he wants to sit down at the conference table, he ought to have a right to do that. I think what we are fighting for is freedom of speech and freedom of movement. And to me, this is simply a reflection of that. I think it means that we are mature. I think we are being honest now. I don't think we ever were all together on all the points. I think we were just trying to fool the white people for a while. That's my honest opinion. Yes? Well, frankly, I'm against tying them in together. I think they are two different issues. My own honest opinion is that Dr. King has made a mistake in tying them together, although he now says he's not tying them together. No, I don't think we should. I think they are two central issues, and I think that whether we should or should not be in Vietnam is a debatable question. But whether we should support the government, to me, is not debatable. I think we should. Yes? Well, I think we're going to have more progress in the future. I think we're going to have more integrated movements. I think Negroes are already being upgraded. I think what has happened now is that we've got to, in addition to fighting to extend more opportunities, I think we've also got to train more Negro people who will be available to take advantage of these opportunities. I know that white people are sincere in some instances in trying to secure qualified Negroes, because I have it difficult. I think Bill Berry has said it very aptly in Chicago, and he says that we've got to save some of the jobs for dumb Negroes and not give them all to dumb white people. And I think that, you know, the white companies expect us to be better than like white employees. And I think we have dumb people that we're not going to be able to train right away, and so there should be some jobs for them. I think the educated people are taking care of themselves these days. The big problem of the future is how to help and develop the uneducated and the unskilled. And I think there are many bright spots in this area. At least we have them around the country in Chicago and several other places. Yes? No, we've never been influenced by the CIA. Well, if they've tried to reach me, I've not been aware of it. I think this, I don't think they'd have to reach us because we are pro-American anyway. So it wouldn't be any reason for them to reach me. I mean, our magazines, I mean, in other words, I have traveled all around the world, and there are many things wrong with this country, but it's still the best country I've visited. And so I say that our job is to make it a better country. And we don't gain anything by running it down in the eyes of the world. I think what we ought to do is the same as we would do in a family. If you disagree with your mother and your father, you fight and you argue when the door is closed, but you don't go next door and tell a neighbor. And so this is my feeling. I think we ought to give America hell in America. But I think when we go outside of America, we ought to be loyal to the country. Yes? Yeah. Do you feel that happening for any publication has anything contributed to creating an atmosphere of achievement in the Negro home that the parent then used to communicate to the child to be more motivated?
Yeah. Well,
Yes, we're trying. I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I think, first of all, we have to admit that it's true. And I think that I, along with many of the other speakers, might be considered the exception rather than the rule. We were fortunate in having the kind of parents who were able to do this. I think there are many other young people who just aren't quite that fortunate. Their parents just don't have this kind of stamina and this kind of discipline and this kind of hope. And so I think, one, we've got to try to motivate the parents, as we're trying to do. And I think, two, we've somehow, we've got to try to begin to motivate the child a little bit earlier in the schools, such as Head Start, in cases where the parents just aren't ever going to do this. I think we have to recognize that some parents are just never going to do it. And I think we should work very hard at trying to get as many parents to do it as possible. And then I think we've got to try to use other means in the schools and in the community and in the churches and in the civic groups to try to motivate those youngsters who are not getting motivation at home. I don't know if that answers your question, but... I'm saying, yes, I think so. As a matter of fact, we've editorialized on the subject many times in Ebony. I think we've tried to show parents that they have a responsibility. We've tried to show that with privilege and with opportunity always goes a certain amount of responsibility. And we've tried to say that in many different ways and in many different forms. But I think we have to realize we're not going to be completely successful. And so I think we have to think of other ways in addition to these that will help to motivate the young people. Yes? Yes. Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. I don't think that any particular group in Chicago can claim credit for doing that. I think that in Chicago we have many forces at work to try to train unskilled people and prepare them for jobs in industry. We have in Chicago an organization called Merit Employment, in which all the industrial leaders have come together and are voluntarily agreeing to employ so many Negroes and to train so many. I know, for example, Carson Peary Scott and Company trains many untrained people. They deliberately seek dropouts. At our own company, we have many dropouts. I just hired a dropout the other day. So I think we have a lot of forces at work in Chicago. I don't think any particular organization can claim credit in Chicago. Frankly, I'm not familiar with it, to tell you the truth. Yes? Mm-hmm. Well, the publication hasn't. I would say to you that in Chicago, we have urban renewal, as they have in many cities, and I belong to a group of Negro businessmen who just recently were granted a $7 million loan from the FHA to build medium-income housing. As a matter of fact, we're breaking the ground for it in about 2 weeks from now, and it will provide additional housing for upwards of about 600 families. So I would say this is a personal effort in which I'm participating in which I have made an investment. Now, I don't believe that industry can solve the problem by itself, if you're asking me that. I think that government has to stay in it. And I think we need both private and governmental developments in order to succeed. I don't think that industry can do the job by itself, and I don't think that private industry can do, I mean, government can do it by itself. I think we need them both. Yes?
considered radio and television?
Yes, we have, and we've stayed out of it because we don't have enough management people to engage in it. In other words, very often, many white companies are, like ours, are able to diversify and buy other companies because they have trained and skilled management which they can send over to run those properties. Unfortunately, we do not have enough trained and skilled people that we can spare to move out into another area. So we have steered clear of broadcasting. I have a friend at Esquire, for example, Esquire Magazine, and Esquire Magazine bought a broadcasting station in Atlanta, and they later sold it because they just didn't have enough personnel to send to Atlanta to run it. And so this is the reason why we've stayed out of broadcasting. As a matter of fact, I think we had a good opportunity to get a UHF station, television station, and we didn't get it, and I'm very glad we didn't get it, because in Chicago, the Marshall Field interests now have a channel called 32 that they've already spent $10 million on, and they are now saying they won't be in the black for another 10 years, and we just don't have that kind of money or that kind of talent. Plus, my mother also told me, never be greedy, you know, be satisfied. And I'm doing fairly well now, so I don't, so I don't want to get into anything else. Any other? Yes.
They have
to you. I have visited Russia, and there's more bread here than there is there. I mean, I visited there, and may I say this to you? Let me just give you an example. I am not trying to defend any kind of racist policies. I think if there are racist policies, they should be exposed. Please understand that. I'm simply saying to you that a man should learn from his experience. He should learn from his travels. And I'm saying to you, I have traveled in almost every country in the world, and I do not know any country where black people are doing better. And I do not make Africa an exception to this. Now, so what I'm trying to say to you, I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm saying it's the best we have. And I'm saying we ought to work on it, we ought to improve it, we ought to fight for it, but until you can show me something better, I'm for it. No, I'm not middle class. I'm just a guy. I don't think there is a solution. You know, I think one of the things you learn about life is that there are no solutions to some problems. You know, everything is not black or white. A lot of things are gray. I say to you that I'm not trying to defend the war in Vietnam. I'm simply saying to you that we are in Vietnam. And I don't think until the country itself as a whole pulls out, I don't see how we can can fight against the war. It's very simple. I'm not advocating the war, and I do not believe that Vietnam is responsible for whatever you say has happened to the civil rights movement. I don't think it's Vietnam. I think it's personal prejudice and bigotry. But it might just as well have happened without Vietnam. Well, let me say it to you, some years ago, when Elvis Presley was very popular, somebody went to W.C. Handy and asked him, "What do you think of Elvis Presley?" W.C. Handy said, "I think every man ought to have the right to make a buck." So I would say in this context, Muhammad Ali has a right to his own opinions. He has a right to promote his movement, and I would not knock it. I just don't happen to believe in it. And I don't think he has to believe in my way any more than I have to believe in his way. I think what we have to recognize is that we're supposed to have a democracy. We're supposed to have free speech. People are supposed to express their views, to promote movements, whether we like it or not. And so I say he has a right to promote his movement. But I don't think he has the right to impose it on me, even though his headquarters are about two blocks from me in Chicago. What is the issue? I'm saying a man has a right to take any position he wants to take. But I don't have to agree with him. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying no more. Are there any others? Yes. I think he did within the context of the age in which he lived and worked. I think we have to realize that Douglass did most of his work before the end of slavery, when there were necessarily a lot of restrictions on what a man could or could not do. And I think the basic problem there was not to establish business. The basic problem was to get freedom. Then after we got freedom, and immediately after the Civil War, I think the big problem then was to get political power. And so I think he addressed himself to it. I don't think he did it as well as perhaps he might have done. But then I don't know that he could have done better, considering the times and the age in which he lived, and the fact that greater emphasis was put on politics and the desire to succeed and control their share of the government. So to answer your question, I think he addressed himself to it. I don't think he did as well as perhaps he should have, but he did address himself to it. Yes. I think it should move in that direction. And by that, I don't mean that we should have black blocks of people. I think that people ought to be active politically, and I think they ought to support candidates that stand for principles and that stand for morality and that stand for the general good of all the people. I think there are some bright spots. A Negro was elected mayor of Saginaw, Michigan last week, and it has a white population. It has a total population of 100,000 and only 16,000 Negro. A Negro was elected mayor of Ypsilanti, Michigan, and it has a population of 20,000, only 4,000 a Negro. And there are also mayors of Springfield, Ohio. There's a Negro mayor of Flint, Michigan. So that I think that, and in Chicago, we now have more than our 20,000, only 4,000 a Negro. And there are also mayors of Springfield, Ohio. There's a Negro mayor of Flint, Michigan. So that I think that, and in Chicago, we now have more than our 20, we're roughly 25% of the population, and we have about 30% representation in the city council. So that I think we are getting more political power. I think we should concentrate on that, yes. What I would like to say in conclusion is that I think we need everything. To the young man who spoke of Muhammad Ali, I think we need him. I'm not knocking him. I think any voice that can be expressed in favor of a more democratic treatment of individuals and should be heard. And as for America, he says, "I'm pro-American. I don't know anything else I could be. I was born in this country. It's been good to me. I think we have to fight." I've never known a situation where there were not problems. You know, men marry wives. I had a man not long ago who
who married a young lady, and before they got married, you know, whenever he'd tell a joke, she'd laugh real loud and say, gee, did you hear what he just said? And then after they got married, he'd tell the same jokes, and she'd say, ah, shut up. I'm saying that to say that nothing is ever quite the way we want it to be. And I don't think we're ever going to reach the millennium. I think problems are always going to be with us. So we've got to grapple with them. And it seems to me that the important thing is not what the problem is, but whether we're working on it, whether we're trying to improve it. Now, if I knew of some other ideology that was better than the American ideology, I would embrace it. As I said before, I was in Russia, for example, a few years ago, and Paul Robeson was still alive. I'm a great admirer of Robeson. But this man who came up to me, the Russian, kept asking me, he was criticizing the fact that the U.S. government at that time wouldn't let Paul Robeson go to London to some sort of peace conference. And he didn't realize that he couldn't even go out of Moscow. I mean, he had to have a pass to get out of Moscow. And here he was, you know, running the United States down because they wouldn't let a man go to a foreign country. So I think everything is relative. We have to judge it by what is available some way up. And I would say if we could find a better system, I would embrace it. But I don't know of a better system. And so until I find a better system, I will be loyal to this system. This does not mean that I have to agree with everything the system says. This does not mean that I'm going to say that it's right all the time. This simply says that I will stay in the system and I will fight to improve it. And that's it, really. Yes, you have a question? Now, I have to be very honest with you. I am not too familiar with his work. As a matter of fact, when I heard the most about Saul Alinsky, he was working with the Back of the Yards Council, and there were not many Negroes there. I understand that later he did work in Woodlawn, and I'm not ducking the question. I'll simply be honest with you and say I'm not familiar with his work, really. But I would also say that any voice that can be heard, I'm not trying to say that it shouldn't be heard. Sibelman, yeah, he's a former editor of Fortune magazine. I don't know. I know what he's trying to say. I mean, what he's really trying to say is that the Southerners, if they're against you, will tell you right away that they're against you, and in many cases, whites in the North will be against you and won't tell you. I think there are two sides to that. One side, of course, is that in the South, the law is against you, and in the North, the law is for you. And I think I would rather have public opinion riding in my favor over the long haul, because there's always a chance that the guy might change his mind and really believe what he's saying he believes. And so if I had a choice, I would rather go with the guy who said he believed it, even if he didn't, because if he says it long enough, he just might come around and believe it.
To keep Mr. Johnson here all night, but if we did, he might go back to Chicago and report that to Mr. Allison Davis, who will be our speaker next week, and then he wouldn't come. So I hope I'll see you all here next week to hear the final lecture in the series. And thank you very much again, Mr. Johnson.